All right, welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. Who day?
Is there any other thing to say? I think we're done. Are we done? We're done.
Who day? Great podcast. Thanks for listening, everyone. Jason Williams, Sherry Coolidge, Silent Phil is back on the ones and twos. He's still silent, too.
Right? I thought he was going to say who day. My bad.
I thought he was going to say something, but nope. Oh, there he is in the background. Our special guest today is Cincinnati interim city manager, John Kerp. He will join us here momentarily.
Nothing like putting a new city manager right on that hot seat.
Right.
To his credit, he said yes right away. He didn't say, well, I'm kind of new. I'm kind of busy. He was like, okay, when do you do it? So to his credit.
Hey, I've always found John Kerp to be very accessible, going back to his days as a city solicitor under Mark Mallory's administration, the mayor, two mayors ago now, goodness, almost a decade ago. But before we jump to have John on, today, as we record here today, is the filing deadline for local and state races. And this is the That's So Cincinnati podcast, so we'll keep it local right now. Looking at the landscape of, there are some, you look at it kind of going into the year and you're like, not a lot going on the local scene in 2022, but now it's seeming like a little more interesting. And two of those races are the county commissioner's seat, where Stephanie Dumas, incumbent county commissioner, is running for reelection. Christopher Smitherman is going to try to make history and win as an independent. And now the Republicans have, after trying to keep the coast clear, the pathway clear for Christopher Smitherman, the Republican, someone came in and still filed as a Republican. That's Matt O'Neill, who ran in 2020 against Denise Driehaus. And so you look at a three-person race there, and it's tough for an independent to win in this landscape of hyper-partisan times. And that's where we're at right now. This is going to be a three-person race, and at least going into this morning, that was my knowledge that that's how that was going to go down. We'll see if by the deadline today if that changes, but generally that is going to be the race. So,
and I will say the Republicans, I was going to be surprised if they didn't have any run. What did you say his first name was? Tim?
Matt. Yes.
Matt. He talked to our Scott Wortman. And my takeaway from that story is he said that he feels like he's a lot more well-known since the earlier race. And my takeaway from that is not really. But his name will be on the ballot. And there are R's and D's. This is not a judge race. And so that'll be telling, a telling thing. And to Stephanie Dumas, her profile has really raised.
Yes.
She has, she got off to, we wrote a lot about what her early days. And she has really become a strong voice over there. And so her profile raised even higher than it already was. She has a lot of support in suburban Hamilton County. And so this race is going to be interesting. I agree.
It is. And you look at it again, just putting your kind of political analysis hat on, and you think, the Democrats have to be cheering that Matt O'Neill is filed, because it makes it incredibly difficult now, because it's going to split votes with Christopher Smitherman. And I will say this, Sherry, and I've written some about it, is that the discussion of whether the Republican Party will still endorse, or at least look to potentially endorse, Christopher Smitherman is still on the table. I'm hearing there will be some executive committee members who bring that up whenever they decide to discuss endorsing in the local races. I'm being told that that will be discussed. But I'm also being told that it's awfully, awfully tough when you do have a Republican in the race to then endorse a non-Republican. So you very well could see that the Republican Party won't endorse in that race. And Matt O'Neill, to be clear, for anyone who don't know, he's not the pick of the party, and that the party didn't recruit him. You know, he would be, you know, what you call in the political world is sort of an insurgent type of.
A real citizen who says, I can make my community better. And we certainly agree with that. I mean, you know, this should never be, we complain all the time, these insider picks and, you know, pave the way and without, you know, cutting deals and who it's going to be. And so certainly, like, this is a real citizen saying, I want to step up.
Yeah. And honestly, the path, as you said, Sherry, you know, he talked about, how can you not have a Republican on there? I'm paraphrasing what he said, but, you know, there's a lot of, this has been a really fascinating, you know, from a political, you know, analyst, political scientist type of, you know, realm. If you're a super political junkie, you know, watching this race kind of unfold and the dance that for really a year now that the Republican Party did with Christopher Smitherman. And there were plenty of people who tried to convince him to run as a Republican and say, hey, you would be the clear cut person that the Republican Party would get behind, endorse, support, for, you know, and to try to break up the all Democrat Board of Commissioners. You know, let's see what happens. Certainly.
And for anyone who thinks I don't care about the commissioners, you do care. We are in the middle of Bengals mania right now, and there are some big decisions to be had. And city council, for all we talk about, city council this and city council that and Mayor Pureval this and Mayor Pureval that. I'm happy to write those stories, but this new set of commissioners are going to make big decisions for this city. They're going to change the future of that stadium. And it really depends, and it's a lot of discussion about what's going to happen with the Bengals. That lease is coming up in 2026, which in, you know, lease times is actually very soon and not, you know, a couple years away. So this election is very, very important, and I encourage everyone. I actually don't know where all the candidates stand on all of this, but that is something that we'll be reporting on, and I encourage everyone to please pay attention. Like, for however you feel about this, listen to what they're saying.
Definitely. And, you know, this commission very well, the commission that's in place right now, and whoever wins this election, along with whoever wins this election in November, will most likely be the commission that steps into the boardroom and does the negotiation. So, on the new stadium lease, Sherry, real quickly, you also have the clerk's race and a couple, you know, maybe people are wondering what some of the former city council members, what happened to Steve Good and what happened to Betsy Sunderman. Betsy Sunderman has filed to run, for domestic relations court judge, to Susan Tolbert is not running again. So Betsy Sunderman's going to run for that. Steve Gooden has decided he is going to run for clerk of courts. And for those of you, again, who pay close attention to this, you're like, wait, why is there didn't the county just elect a clerk of courts in 2020? Yes, but there's actually now – it's not called a special election. It's just called an election to finish out the term of Aftab Pureval, who obviously went on to be mayor because he stepped down from that before the midway point of the term. So then that triggered then that there will be an election this fall. And Steve Gooden, Pavan Parikh from the Democrats, who was appointed, who's now currently the clerk of courts, to finish out at least through the end of this year. And then the election will determine who serves in that seat and finishes out the term the final 2 years. You know, I mean, I know we don't usually talk a lot about clerk of courts race, but I think this will be certainly one interesting to watch.
And the Republicans, they're going to want to take it back.
Absolutely.
You know, they had that seat for decades and decades before Mayor Pureval won that seat. And they are going to be looking hard to recapture that.
Yeah. And the big reason why is because outside of the sheriff's department, there is no bigger office of patronage jobs than the clerk of courts office. So you certainly when you talk about power and influence in county government, the clerk of courts certainly is an important job. Sherry, I think, yeah, we'll certainly.
All right, let's talk about city news.
Let's talk about city news, but certainly keep up with all that stuff on Cincinnati.com. Scott Wortman, our Hamilton County reporter, I'll weigh in with columns as well on it. Yeah, so we'll jump over and bring on interim Cincinnati City Manager, John Kirk. All right, special guest time here on the That's So Cincinnati podcast, and really excited to welcome to the podcast a new name on the scene now, but a blast from the past as well. Interim Cincinnati City Manager John Kirp. John, how you doing?
I'm great. Thank you for having me. My wife told me this morning that, you know, my appearance on this podcast made me officially Cincinnati famous. So
intriguing, intriguing.
Appropriate title for today.
I do have to say, anytime now, I'm going to write a story and remember to put interim before your name, and my editor's not going to have to be like, "You didn't write interim." Any second, I'm going to remember that.
Well, you're a couple weeks into this officially. Is it anything similar to when you were, and we let our listeners know you were the city solicitor back in almost a decade ago. Is there anything like your previous role? Can things that you took from your previous role be applied to this job, or is it just like drinking from a fire hose and a brand new thing? Or what's this been like for you?
There's everything is familiar, but I've got to say, obviously there's been 8 years of information I haven't been kept up to speed on a daily basis, just at the level of managing an organization this size. So I've spent the last month, I had a great transition with Paula Boggs-Muthing. She was very helpful, but there's still nothing like getting your feet on the ground in the office and answering the emails and questions that come on a daily basis to come at you fast. I think things are starting to slow down. You use football analogies now, starting to see the field and understand who the players are and what their skills and weaknesses and strengths are. And so I think, we're starting to get our feet under us. And I tell everyone, our council and our mayor hit the ground sprinting. I'm a month behind them. And so we're working hard to catch up with their enthusiasm and excitement about everything that they want to do here at City Hall.
Do you feel like you're the Joe Burrow of City Hall then? Are we using football analogies?
I've got to be careful. All right.
Aftab is the mayor here of all.
I've been told I have a little too much swagger sometimes, but I think my role is to, like I said, channel with their energy into the administration.
What do you see? Describe what you see the role as. When Mayor Puraval approached you and said, I really want you to step into this role, we're having a big transition, what did you tell him? Take us into the kind of that conversation a little bit.
Sure. I think he asked me what my view of city government was from an outsider's perspective, but as someone who kind of knew how this government has worked in the past and has worked the last 8 years is, not an insider, but a close observer of city government. I said, you have a lot of good people there, a lot of people who work hard, they're committed public servants. They want to be professionals. They want to provide, the best advice that they can to our city. And, I saw my opportunity to lead as being one to just kind of activate and motivate and lead this group of people that we have here to offer what is, I keep describing as, best in class service for our city.
John, had this been, obviously when you were city solicitor and under then Mayor Mark Mallory and John Cranley comes in and people move on, and had this been on your radar? Had this been a goal that you wanted to return to City Hall someday and return to City Hall as potentially, being the city manager? Was this something that you had thought about years ago or?
Well, I've had a passion for public service my entire life. I came to Cincinnati. I was recruited here by the manager at the time to come from Columbus, Ohio, where I was practicing law. It was an opportunity kind of, you know, to lead in a major American city. And that's kind of been my passion. I'm not afraid to admit I was disappointed to the last city government when I did, because I think, you know, we had brought the law department a long way, and I think restored its reputation and prominence in the Cincinnati legal community. But I think I left it in good stead. I left it in a good place. I went back to private practice, and as I tell most people, I've been practicing law 25 years. I've only spent 6 in public service. It was an opportunity to get back to what was a passion of mine, and the opportunity presented itself, and I'm excited to, you know, be able to take it.
So you talked about coming to Cincinnati. The person who brought you here, City Manager Milton Dehoney, he's still in that public service realm. Have you called him and asked him for advice? And what has he said, if so?
Well, you know, he was a mentor of mine here. And I think, you know, part of my interest in this job is the way he managed me and led all the other directors in the city, which was frankly, you know, is the city's attorney. I came from private practice where we were genuine advisors to our clients. We would be proactive in providing legal advice and leadership. And that's kind of that was the tone of my interview with him, you know, 15 years ago. And he allowed me the freedom to go out and be involved in all different departments of our city and to provide proactive advice. I think for the first time ever, we were, you know, lawyers were going out to the directors, the managers, and learning what their business strategies were, learning how they wanted to implement their, you know, their objectives in their particular expertise and specialty area. And that was kind of the focus of my leadership, and Milton encouraged that. But what it did is provided me valuable experience in how to and all of the various components of how the city works. I heard from all the prior managers. I received calls from Harry Black and Milton Dehoney and Patrick Duhaney. All started with a chuckle, quite frankly. Said, welcome to the big chair.
Let me
There's
add
no
to
place
that.
Like Cincinnati.
Yep.
But they all offered encouragement and support, and I think there is a community of city managers in this country that I've kind of stayed in touch with since I left City Hall, and I think we all rely on each other. And kind of like I told our team, there are places where I expect us to lead, but we're also not going to be afraid to take the best ideas from around the country and kind of do them the Cincinnati way. So it's a great network to have, and I guess I will be leaning on it quite a bit.
John, you alluded to, and speaking of, you know, all the work that, you know, you've done in city government, and you alluded to really revamping the entire law department when you were the city solicitor. And I've had people say it was a mess. I mean, I've heard the word mess used when you came into the job, and a great accomplishment for you that you really you overhauled the whole department. And talk about without getting too far in the weeds, the work you had to do there and why it was important to fix that.
Well, you know, quite frankly, the reputation of the law department is that, you know, at a time where economic development was the top priority in the city, it's where deals went to die.
Oh, wow.
And that was a reputation in the business community and the legal community. And quite frankly, we were getting our butts kicked at the courthouse on everything from just, you know, regular daily legal issues to arbitrations and disciplinary matters of the city. And, you know, I evaluated the skill and talent that we had. We had a lot of young, passionate people, people who had been there a long time, but we just didn't have that that gravitas in the legal community. And I made a concerted effort to go out and find skilled, experienced lawyers who are, you know, came from the best law schools in the country, working at the best law firms. And I'm not afraid to kind of tell the story, but, you know, I did kind of a tour of all the law firms in town when I got here to introduce myself. But part of that was a recruiting trip. And I went to kind of share my passion and vision for what the law department could be. And I was able to, frankly, recruit top talent from some pretty big law firms in town. I couldn't pay them more, but I could offer some really young, smart people opportunities to lead in areas of law where they had passion for. And we brought that talent here. We had, I think, 3 new economic development lawyers within the first couple of years that came from major law firms who are working for big clients on big deals. And, to have that talent in-house here, I think kind of changed how we did things at City Hall and the perspective of the legal community as they looked at the city.
Did you come to City Hall with kind of a to-do list? Or I know you have said often that you're listening. Have you formulated a to-do list at this point?
I think the initial to-do list was to let all the directors know, hey, look, you're empowered to lead. You're the subject matter experts in all the areas that you touch. Let's lead. Let's do it. I want to hear your best advice. I want it unfiltered. I want it in a way that we can review it, analyze it, present it to council. That's been my agenda to date. To the extent we're going to do things any differently, I want to be sure that when council gets legislation in front of it, it comes with our best information, our best advice, and with a solid recommendation is what we believe the course should be. A recommendation we believe in. And if the policymakers want to change that, want to influence it, that's their call. That's why they're elected and put in the positions that they're in. But they're going to get the best advice from us. I think I see the directors responding to that. I've already gotten, presented with ideas and information about things they think could work better in the city. And, I think they're all excited for that. So that's kind of what I'm looking to achieve. That's my kind of short-term objective. And quite frankly, I made it clear, hey, look, if you haven't followed this election, then you haven't done a good job as directors in getting a sense for what the pulse of the community is and our elected officials. You see their agenda. That's where they're headed. How do we adapt our mission to kind of fit what those broader policy objectives are.
Coming in, can you give us an assessment of where you think our basic services are? Because I do think that sort of it wasn't the headlines of this past election, but it certainly was an underpinning. And it has been the beginning of this. We don't have enough public safety, public services. People are saying, we're really at this critical point in several areas. I mean, where do you, can you, how about let's give a grade to where we stand with public services in the city as a starting point?
Yeah, I think we have the core of all of those things. I really do. We have the top public safety departments in the country. I mean, they're the best equipped, the best trained, and we're going to keep, we're going to keep and maintain that. COVID has done a lot to this. Quite frankly, I've had directors who haven't met and talked to each other in weeks and months. We've got COVID kind of put everyone in their silos, right? You're focused on your narrow area without kind of that interaction that we all used to kind of crave as providing that energy and creativity. I think we have an opportunity to, I've told directors, we're going to break down those silos and get back to engaging each other. And I don't think that our public services are suffering. I think we've got, like I said, great people doing hard work. There's always room to improve. And I think coming out of COVID, I hope very soon, we'll be able to kind of re-energize and relook at how we do things to kind of pick up where we feel it's a new world. It's an opportunity to kind of reinvent the basics of how we do things. And I think we need to look at it strategically and work toward those goals. And quite frankly, it's community engagement. What do our citizens want to see? What do our constituencies want to see out of government in the next 5 to 10 years? We need that strategic, do that work to develop a strategic direction for where we're headed.
Do you think we'll see something like that? Of course, we're going to start seeing the budget, I hate to say, pretty soon, even though it's February. But do you expect that yourself and the mayor will be putting forward, this is really what we want these 4 years to look like?
Yeah, I think so. I think we've already seen, you know, the mayor has been, you know, very explicit in what his, you know, what his initiatives are, what he campaigned on. I think this council's for the most part aligned with those policy objectives. And we, you know, we need to look at strategically at what happens. I think kind of frankly, the worst thing that I could do as a manager is start getting into, you know, frankly, getting into the weeds of how we're, and just focus on day to day. How are we doing things today? I think we need to look at strategically at what our long-term objectives are, identify them. There may be a time and place to come and kind of, you know, and I think if you look at other governments across the country, you know, every 10 to 15 years, we do some type of professional analysis, a study, a strategic plan as to where we are as a community, where we want to head, engage our citizens. So I think that that's, I think that's an agenda, especially once I think we get our feet after kind of these first 100 days and get this first budget out of the way. Because quite frankly, I think we all know there's a waterfall out there we're looking at with income tax revenue and federal ARP money running out eventually. So we do need a long-term plan as to, you know, what our government looks like. How do we balance the budget? How do we bring it to structural balance? Because, you know, we haven't had one and we won't have one for a few more years as we kind of figure out how income tax revenue is going to catch up with our new post-COVID reality.
Is it too soon to be asking you, like, what is the thoughts about bringing people back into the office? I know, you know, City Hall employees under the last administration were really asked to come back as kind of set an example of, mm-hmm. you know, being in the office. But that doesn't seem to be the case with a lot of other businesses in Cincinnati. And so how big a priority is that? And can City Hall even dictate that?
I think we have to be, you know, we have to be leaders in that. I know that even prior to taking office, the mayor brought together business leaders in the community and other constituents to talk about how we, how, you know, the economic recovery plan in a post-COVID Cincinnati. And I think the consensus was amongst most businesses in town that we've got to focus on bringing our, you know, getting our workers back into the offices when it's as soon as possible, when it's safe to do so. And I expect the city will be side by side with our partners in the business community and leading that. So again, to me, it's important that people see their city government working, and the optics of you know, frankly, seeing City Hall full and busy of people doing their jobs is important to the community.
John, you get about a week into the job as interim city manager, and you know, really the first big kind of, you know, serious thing happens with the police cadet John Brown suffering the medical emergency. And you know, I wrote a column critical of the elected officials, and certainly that's not critical of you at all. You have your job to do, and I believe you're doing it. But is there anything, you know, I know you can't speak to his personal medical issue, and I don't want you to, but is there anything you can share right now in terms of where that situation is in terms of, like, hey, is there something wrong with the police training? Is there what can you say to that, you know, right now? Is there an investigation on looking into this? Yeah, you know, we saw the videos, and I'll just say, just from the naked eye of looking at the video, that there didn't seem to be anything out of the normal there. But hey, what does the city manager, you know, what's your role in that, and what's going on?
Sure. No, and again, our first, you know, our first priority is frankly the health of the officer and his recruit class and trainers too. I mean, there's a lot that we need to we're embracing and supporting all those our police force in this situation. And as I said earlier, we have the best trained police force in the nation. They really do take pride in developing and providing best in class training for urban policing, and the physical, the mental requirements are, I think, again, top of the class. Yes, there will be a review. I mean, it's necessary to do it. We, you know, we went through a professional process when this happened. We gathered facts. You know, we have a risk management team, an employee safety team in the city. It's a civilian team that would investigate any workplace incident that involves the health of an employee of the city. And there'll be a memo coming out soon to council and to the mayor to kind of describe it in detail that process. But, you know, we have investigators full time, extremely skilled, who will work and will seek the help from the state where necessary to make sure that, you know, we engaged in, you know, if there's any practices that should be reviewed.
Are you seeking outside look at this? Because when you say a risk management, I mean, things I'm familiar with, having done this for a long time. Typically you would think that a big incident would have an internal police review, but of course it involves themselves. And when you say risk management, to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, that's risk management is like, what kind of risks does this pose to the city? Like, risk management to me is like, what is the city? What kind of position is the city in now? As opposed to, I'm not getting the sense that there's an investigation into what happened and if anything needs to change.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying it does.
Risk management is not a litigation bunker. That's not where we're. It's not where we're headed. It's a typical process that frankly every corporation, in the country, deals with. It's a function they all have. As you, we're always looking how to make our workplace safe. And frankly, risk management is our term for our insurance group, right? Our health and safety group. That's the process where we'll start. Again, we have subject matter experts in that area. If there's something that falls outside their expertise, we'll seek help. And in most investigations, we have access to state regulatory entities that look at workplace issues. And if they can, we're not afraid to ask for expertise if we don't have it. And, we'll engage those sources. If we get to the end of the process and we need more information, we'll seek it. I certainly expect the police they will review their academy training. I think, frankly, they do that every year to make sure that they're staying up to date and providing the best training that we can. So it will be transparent. I think that's important. I think we had the videos within 24 hours of, when I became aware of them, we had them ready in 24 hours. And that was important because, frankly, when you're not transparent, the rumors start to flow and inaccurate information becomes the narrative instead of, I think what we all know and hope to be was something that was just an unfortunate set of circumstances that leaves us all hoping for a good outcome.
Can you right now promise to the public that questions will be answered? Because the last time something this big happened with Kyle Plush, we had two internal reviews that answered no questions that the public had, spinning things like completely, a real outside investigation didn't start for months. We didn't have answers for months after that. And something very critical, which was our 911 center, which remains under, court supervision at this point, basically, as a result of all of that. And that there's a lot of questions there on top of everything else right now. Can you promise to the public that we're not going to have to go through months, that whatever review this looks like, the questions will be answered in it?
Yeah, well, yes. we're gonna answer questions and honestly value the role of the media in asking those questions. I think it's important. I frankly fully expect our council members are going to have lots of questions to ask, and we'll answer the we'll answer those. I haven't heard them ask any questions. Because it's we're doing the public business.
I haven't heard them ask any questions.
Well, I think right now, I've briefed them informally about what's coming as far as our risk management review or employee safety, by our employee safety division. I think right now we're focused on the health and of our recruit and his family. So you know, there's time, but we're not going to rush either. That's why I commit to a time. No, because to me, the time is when we have all the facts, all the information. And it's really even too soon, without knowing all the health issues that are still pending out there that really aren't timely for disclosure, that as part of the process too. So we're trying to balance all those delicate things. Yeah, do it right and do it in a timely way.
Okay. No, I appreciate that. I do. And well, you know, I know those things don't happen overnight, even though I want them to, but I know they don't. So I appreciate this, I think, brings a lot of clarity to the process right now.
Go ahead, John.
And where there are gaps in what we do, we'll go back and we'll keep looking. I mean, again, there's nothing to hide. We all want our employees to be safe and when they come to work and when they go out to work, be prepared to do their jobs. And no one more than our public safety employees are at the very top of that list of people we want to be sure are safe and prepared to go out and do their jobs.
Yeah, John, I know this is you're looking from where the administration you came from, Mark Mallory, you worked with a veteran council, a veteran mayor, a lot of veteran elected officials. Just throwing this out there to you, just getting your thoughts on it, if you can share. Are you a little surprised that the elected officials haven't been asking more questions publicly? And I've written a couple columns about it, but you know, you would think that. And again, you're doing your job, and it's no criticism of you, but it's their job as having been elected by the people to, I think, you know, ask questions about this. And are you a little surprised? You know, again, having come from the city hall you came from, and where, hey, you know, people let their feelings known, they let their questions known. Mm-hmm. Let me just ask you, are you a little surprised by it? And if so, why?
No, I think, I mean, those councils were all very different. I had three different councils while I was here, much, much different personality than this group, collective personality. I have been engaged, if there's anything I think a little bit different than, and from my background and experience, I had excellent personal relationships with virtually every council member I worked with as solicitor. And building those relationships with this group of council members is important to me on an individual basis. It's not something I wanted to delegate to someone else to, kind of interface with. I've sat down and talked with every single one of them. They all had questions. So I think they have asked, they have inquired, they've all expressed concerns about safety. They've all asked how they can reach out to the officer and their family and our cadet class. They've all been engaged. Perhaps the only difference is as you alluded to, Jason, maybe you're just not seeing it in the form of lots of tough questions at a committee meeting or
public debate or a kind of thing. Yeah.
So they've asked, they've been active, they've inquired, we've provided them as many updates as we can when we get the information, and maintaining that level of communication is important to me. So, I think they have been involved and engaged.
I think you even said it in your, that first, kind of official meeting was, talking about the big decision of hiring a new police chief. Does Chief Isaac have a,
departure date
yet? And then, does he have that?
He'd be helping me a lot because it's on my to-do list because I got to figure out what that date is. So if you could just tell me right now, then I can cross that off.
Yeah, Chief Isaac's a great leader of the city. There are no Tom Brady stories here today. I'm not preempting the chief and the precise timing of his departure.
Here's that football analogy again. Okay, fair enough.
Hey, but we're in that mode right now, and you can feel free to use as many of those as you can. Super Bowl-bound Bengals.
I try to avoid them, but... I've talked to the chief. I've talked to the chief about a plan when he departs. We've been actively preparing for the search. The mayor will probably have an announcement in the next week or so about the process. But the process is going to be one of very broad community engagement and developing the criteria and qualifications for the chief, and one where we truly intend to include all the constituencies in the city. And it will actually, and I've talked to the chief, it will include his input on the quality and characteristics of what we need for the next leader of the police department. So that will all be coming very soon, because I know it's a priority. We need to get that process engaged and do so in a way that is deliberate and the community sees as being very transparent.
What else do we want to ask you about? Sherry's looking at me like I'm looking at her. John, tell us a little bit about yourself. I mean, we dove right into all the serious business. Tell us a little, like, where you're from. I know you went to Miami. You know, you're just life away from City Hall, John Kirby.
Sure. No, I grew up in Dayton, Ohio. I lived Reds and Bengals as a kid. My hero was Joe Morgan. My dream was to play shortstop for the Cincinnati Reds someday. I'm almost getting close to the age where I might have to let that one go. But I've been in Southwest Ohio all my life. Cincinnati was always a trip to the big city for me. It was a big special day to go to the ballpark, go to a game. I've been around public service my entire life. My father was a long time elected official in our community, just outside, in our basically kind of a large working class suburb of Dayton. So I grew up around budgets and collective bargaining and school issues and city issues. And so it's kind of been part of my life for a long time. Proud graduate of Walter East Evans High School on the east side of Dayton. Went from there to Miami University, where I studied business and finance, and quite frankly, pursued that education because my dad always believed that the best preparation for a career in government was business training. So I was a finance major at Miami. Went from there to law school, Indiana University in Bloomington, and was there for 3 years and did my summers, actually clerked one summer with the law firm I started with, Tasta, Tennies & Hollister, and then spent a second summer as a law clerk at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Louisville, Kentucky. And then, started my career off in Columbus, at a major law firm. I was a real estate economic development lawyer, engaged and worked in government. I did a lot of zoning and land use, and that was kind of my area of specialty in the firm. But worked very closely with our attorneys here in Cincinnati out of the Columbus office. So when I came down here, it actually made the transition very easy because I was already well networked with the legal community in my firm and made the introductions very, very easy. So I have a beautiful wife, 5 children. We're a blended family of 5. We call ourselves the Bradys without Alice. We all need an Alice in our lives. Somewhere.
We all need an Alice for her sage advice. So the Coolidges don't have to eat dinner at 9 o'clock and have a child at 8:45. Be like, can you two get off the phone? There's no food. Yes, we all need an Alice.
I have 5 kids in Cincinnati public schools. I've had one just graduated from Walnut Hills last year. She's a brilliant first-year student at Smith College. 3 others at Walnut. I'm sure the faculty at Walnut Hills will be tired of me. My youngest is 10. So I calculate I probably will, been a Walnut parent for about 15 years by the end of my time there. But most of the time is, I'm not working. I'm usually driving kids around town, trying to get them back and forth to sports and drama and swimming and everything else that parents try to balance nowadays.
So. You know what, though? That's so Cincinnati. And I appreciate that so much. I mean, the older I get, when we talk to people and we're interviewing them, like, it is part of life. When CPS schools closed, and anyone can feel free to go back and listen to the Eve Bolton podcast, it was like, how are we going to take care of our kids? And we all understand that. Like, if I call yourself, you know, the mayor I know drops his child off at school, and we're also involved in our children, and I think that makes us very us.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yes, collective UGG at our house, and, you know, we have to figure out how to, you know, two working parents are going to get through the day when we don't have someone to sit at home with a, you know, fourth grader to make sure they're doing their work, right? Yeah, it's a challenge, but we love Cincinnati. It's been a great place for me and my family, and you know, just proud to be part of this community. I do really think it's a place that truly embraces. We all embrace each other. We may get a little prickly at times, but truly, I think this community is very special.
Does City Hall have a plan to help the Bengals win?
You know, where's this going?
You know, I have been looking. I got a Chris Collinsworth jersey in 1980 before the first Super Bowl that they were in, and I think I still have tears soaking there. So the collective force and energy of this city is behind this team. It's amazing. And we raised the flag at City Hall last week, and it's still flying for the Bengals. And you know, like I said, the energy that a winning sports team brings to this community is incredible. And it, you know, as the mayor's described, it's this team is kind of, I think, frankly, taken on the characteristics of our community. We got a swagger, but we're tough, we're gritty. Put our noses down and get it done. And like I see, you watch this team, it's really exciting because I think they all genuinely like each other. I mean, you just see that community there. And I think that in a lot of ways it just kind of represents us. And the energy of this season has been amazing. I've been a long time season ticket holder. I drove down from Columbus to games, and just watching an excited stadium is amazing.
I have one last question. It's a tough one, so I hope you're prepared for it.
Oh, good.
He's kind of smiling, and we're going to be okay. Shoot, Jason.
Do you still have the Chris Collinsworth jersey?
Oh, you know, I went away to college, and it's one of those things you pack things in shifts. And that was the year they went to the second Super Bowl. And I went home to retrieve that jersey from Miami. And my mom is a pediatric nurse at Children's Hospital in Dayton. And she found it sitting in the closet, and she gave it away to one of the patients that she was taking care of. And I was like, oh, I was so angry, but how could I be angry at her for where she put that jersey?
Yeah.
No, I don't. And my challenge is I would love a vintage Collinsworth jersey from somewhere. That would be kind of, but it's gotta be from that era. I'm not printing a new name on a new jersey. Right. So,
it's gotta be vintage.
No, I don't have it. I'm dying.
I get that. Jack has basically not taken off his Joe Burrow jersey, and I'm not a keeper or a saver, but I'm going to tuck that away for him.
Well, I've got to say, I had a cursed number 9 jersey hanging in my closet that I refused to wear for a decade, but I couldn't get rid of it.
Was that a Carson Palmer? Would that mean it's a Carson Palmer jersey?
Are we allowed to speak that name? I'm not sure.
We're in the now.
Right. So yes, but I have my cool Joe number 9 that is frankly undefeated. So I'm very proud of wearing that jersey right now.
Or you could do what I've seen some people do is put the tape over the Palmer name and write Burrow on it.
That's so Cincinnati.
Yes, I have seen that. I debated that, but I thought, you know, nope. We need to start fresh. This is a whole new day. So,
you know, I think that's a perfect way to wrap this up. We need to start fresh, and it's a whole new day. And John, thanks so much for joining us here today, and you know, talking everything from tough city policies to the Bengals. So all the best to you as you move forward and kind of, you know, get further into the job.
Great. Well, thank you. And thanks for making me Cincinnati famous today. I appreciate it.
Thanks again to John Kerp for joining us here today. And hopefully someone is out there enjoying wearing that Chris Collinsworth jersey.
Agreed.
That the John Kurt bought over 30 years ago. And that brings us, that segues us nicely into our That's So Cincinnati moment of the week. And of course, it revolves around the Bengals. And Sherry, you provide us with that moment.
I have never seen Cincinnati like I saw it on Sunday night downtown. The sheer joy and energy was just invigorating, honestly. As part of the Coolidge's healthy lifestyle living resolutions, we did not drink during the game. We watched it. We had a great time. But afterwards, I was starting to see on social media, like, downtown really seemed exciting. And I was like, let's go take a peek. We don't live that far from downtown. We drove downtown. We ended up in honest, there's no other way to describe it. We were, came in downtown on 2nd Street, and it was like an impromptu parade. We were in just this line of cars beeping and honking. People were hanging out of their sunroofs, and there's just, Hooday was just this constant chant of it. And fireworks. It was really just incredible to see. And I was really having trouble like coming up with when I saw that kind of magic downtown. And it was a collective feeling of a city. And I was just really happy to see that. And it felt like it wasn't just for the Bengals, that it was for Cincinnati. And it was, and I walked away with that, and that's how I feel.
And then, so how long are you guys, you said that was around the banks. I remember seeing our photojournalist Meg Vogel was all over, and she was out tweeting photos and videos of the folks doing that. I saw a guy stand on the roof, or not the roof, but the hood of his car.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if it's his car or not, but
yep.
Imagine that times like a million if they win the Super Bowl. Like, you'll have tons of people standing on roofs and in hoods of cars and hopefully just enjoying themselves, and nothing else gets too crazy beyond that. But how long were you guys down for, till late that night?
No, I mean, we were tired and we had to work the next day. But we stayed long enough to see all of that and really just take it all in and enjoy it and walk away with the moment that we did. I know people stayed. The team rolled up to the stadium in the buses. I saw that later on social media. There was just the cheering, and they just really created like this, you know, this line of people to greet them. And then, you know, the team, they fanned out and brought game balls places again. Like, that's a new thing this season. And it's provided an energy. It's taken this downtown, there's Paul Brown Stadium, and it's lit up orange and everything. And it's taken it out into the neighborhoods, into the sports bars where people go to enjoy games, and, you know, and have gone for years to enjoy games, no matter what the outcome. And now they're in those same places, and there's a game ball, you know, right over there in some sort of like trophy case or sitting on the bar. And that's pretty great.
It is great. And it's, let's, and I know there's a pep rally coming up Monday at Paul Brown Stadium. Yep. For the team. I think you'll see a lot of that same enthusiasm at that, and maybe more so. You know what I say? Cincinnati wins no matter what in this. Like, I think it's – I said this before.
I say when we win, not if we win, and encourage everyone to say that. We put that out there. When?
I honestly, when? I mean, just I think the Bengals are going to win. I really do. I think that there's just something about – this team reminds me a lot – of the 2009 UC Bearcats team under Brian Kelly, is that nothing is going to stop them. In that it's a team that if it gets down, that it doesn't get rattled. It doesn't, you know, hang its head on the sideline. It just says, you know, whatever, we don't care what everyone else is thinking. We're going to find a way, and they're finding ways to do it. I just had that feeling. I remember as a UC alum, that team wasn't going to lose. It was going to find a way. And I have that same feeling now about this Bengals team. So you rarely get that feeling about teams. And, here they are. Exciting times. Enjoy it. Hey, thank
we'll
you.
We'll get a Bengals related guest next week.
Yes. And I want to say too, thank you so much for your support of Cincinnati.com, the Inquirer. Lots of people ran out and bought print Inquirers this past Monday after the FC Championship.
If you missed it, and if you slept in at all, you might have, you can buy, go to our website, you can buy like a really nice frameable copy of that front page, which there is no greater headline. It is us. Mm-hmm. I got teary when I saw it. And for a minimum $20 donation to the neediest kids of all, and that is an Inquirer supported charity. You guys, this is like the best charity, and maybe I'll talk about it in future podcasts. There's so little overhead for it. When you donate to this charity, you know, when schools need things for kids, it could be anything. This is the kind of charity that's like, we got you and can provide, you know, any kind of help they need. This isn't like this isn't specific. This is coats. This is just, we want to help kids with very little overhead. So your money is going to a great thing, and you know, frame it, hang it up in the basement.
Yep. And just go on Cincinnati.com, search neediest kids of all. That story will pop up. It'll tell you exactly how to essentially you're purchasing your frameable front page of the Inquirer from this past Monday with a donation to the organization. So that'll tell you about how to go about that. And I'll tell you, be looking for a week from this coming Monday. And if the Bengals win, there will be another front page that you'll want to frame. So thank you so much for joining us here today, and we will catch you next week.